Hi, welcome back to Spill the Wine. It's me, Christoph Ellinghaus, me and my interview podcast. Today's guest is the fabulous Krist Novoselic, that tall, lanky, bouncy, hugely energetic bass player of the last band that actually changed the course of rock music. Remember them? Nirvana. It's a long time ago, I guess. When Krist and I first met in, I think, 1989, he introduced himself to me by his Americanized name, Chris. But then the war in the former Yugoslavia broke out and he was compelled to make a statement and changed his name to the original Croatian version. And that is Krist, with a K in the beginning and a T at the end. That was the name his parents had given him in the first place. And Krist Antony Novoselic. Very excited to have him on this program. He was born in the future hip-hop capital of Compton. Then the family moved to San Pedro in California. And eventually they relocated to the great Pacific Northwest, where he and his pals would go on and write rock history with their grunge thing, putting a temporary halt on all things poodle rock and hair metal. I don't think it lasted. Or as cynics would call him, he's the other one from Nirvana, as in the one that didn't do interesting or newsworthy stuff like kill himself or start another band and continue to play loud rock music in arenas. No, our man somewhat decided to actually do far more interesting and important things than those profane options for a rock star. He got all political without actually participating in official politics. That's what you call an activist, right? So yeah, post-Nirvana, Krist actually did what I find is the most interesting post-Nirvana activity of all those three post-Nirvana band members. Wait, that was Pat Smear. Let's not go there now. One obviously decided it was better to burn out than to fade away. One decided to keep on rocking in the free world, and the other one turned into a proper and passionate political activist. That's right. He went back to university, he studied, he got his fundamental knowledge on, and has since been using his sort of celebrity status or his prominence in the rock world to get heard speaking out on various issues. Well, we don't have to worry about him financially. I think he's doing fine. He didn't have to run and look for a new day job right after his time in Nirvana. His bass lines are obviously a gift that keeps on giving when you were in one of the biggest bands in the world. He lives a fairly modest life of farming on the coastline of rural Oregon. It's beautiful out there. He's really quite active as a political mind. Well, we're going to talk about all this. He especially works a lot with and for this group called fairvote.org, who focus on all the systemic problems that surround the US-American election procedures. You know, that's that system where the candidate with the most popular vote doesn't win the election in the end. It's that system with a weighted electoral college with, you know, delegates and superdelegates, a system that adds new words to our vocabulary all the time, like this word gerrymandering that we heard the other day from Mary, but also old phrases like "let's get the best government money can buy." So yeah, if you did listen to my chat with the fabulous Mary Manzini a few weeks or episodes back, then you already somewhat know where this is going, but not really. And you should listen to Mary Manzini because she's great. That was a great chat. This year is still a bit different. On this year program, Krist Novoselic is very passionately marching. Now he's racing right into the very depth and the very nitty gritty of US electioneering. That's a good word. Electioneering. That's exactly what's going on here. And he has a few fairly more outside and more critical views in comparison again to Mary of the American two-party democracy. So be warned, this is not exactly the great lost grunge episode of Spill the Wine. This is Krist Novoselic actually getting very, very specific. This is me letting a few things slip by which we'll talk about that after the interview. Let's do an appraisal section, okay? So, let's go. Here we go. Chris Novoselic and me, spill the wine.
Sure, ask me anything you want.
When you were, when you came, you remember when you came to Berlin first? Remember what that day that was?
In 1989, November.
Yeah, November 11, I think. Was it 10 or 11?
Something like that. It was crazy.
Streets were completely congested, right?
Yeah, it was, people were.
November 9, the wall opened up.
Yeah, the wall
opened up. And then 2 days later, you pull into Berlin.
Yeah.
Remember that?
I remember.
You're like, what the hell?
What's going on here? But we knew what was going on. We knew that there was history and we were excited. Everybody was excited. We just couldn't avoid that.
So on that tour, and I think later on when I saw you too, you were just thrashing things all the time. You were bashing your instruments. You were thrashing things. And I was just, I have the very simple question. How did you do that? You would have to wake up. You weren't a big band. You didn't have much money. You were probably,
I don't know how we did it.
Low budget tour. You had to replace every morning. You had to look at the damage.
Well, and a lot of it was, I don't know. It's amazing when I look back at the things that we got away with. It's incredible. It just was magic. I don't know. They were cheap instruments. I mean, we weren't like.
You weren't in love with your whatever precision.
No, we had we were going to pawn shops or, you know, this all used old gear. You know, by the late 80s, you know, you could buy musical instruments from the 70s for really cheap.
Yeah. Right.
That were good instruments until we got a hold of them.
Yeah. I remember at Lame Fest in London, you were swinging your bass like a baseball bat. And all
yeah,
that.
I think
it
so.
Was, it was nuts.
And I'm not a sports fan. Not
right.
really.
Right. Wasn't there some incident where it came crashing on you?
Oh, yeah. I caught that bass like that of 100 times. That's the only time I really dropped it. It was in front of 300 million people. That's my fate.
That was some MTV thing, right?
Yeah. That's the way things happen.
Good done. Well done. And then the other one is like, how heavy was the what's the word? Like the fame guilt?
I don't know if it was guilt. It was just adjusting to it all. Like you have to make a transition
right
to this new life. And so it could be traumatic. Or it was for me, it was confusing just coming somebody who really didn't feel like a mainstream person. And all of a sudden, like I had to be in the mainstream or the mainstream shows up at your front door. And so you just have to deal with it. But now I'm perfectly adjusted.
Well, you're
ready to
old enough.
I'm old enough. Yeah.
Okay. So, so you came to terms with that fairly quickly or?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Did you feel that you were part of that was a machine that was pushing you ahead and you were like kind of.
It was a rocket ride. It was just like a rocket took off and you're just hanging on to it. And I think about that from like 1990, that time from 1991 to 1994, that was only like 3 years maybe, but it seems like that. When I look back, like it was 10 years, like there was so much going on and it was so intense and so like time was compressed.
Yeah.
So there was a lot going on.
Stressful.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. So I guess you guys were always political. You always took a stance.
Well,
even the band, I mean, in the band you were.
You know, we read newspapers and like I always voted in presidential elections since 1984 was the first time I ever voted. So I always try to pay attention.
But you as a band, I think you made certain, you played benefits and things
like
that.
Yeah, we did
right?
that. I mean, we were like, the music wasn't necessarily political and we weren't like one of those overtly political punk bands because we grew up listening to American hardcore music, punk music, and it was a lot of it could be very political. And then a lot of it wasn't either, you know, like Meat Puppets or Butthole Surfers and Scratch Acid, that was not political, but you know, it came out of this whole kind of underground world. And, so those were some of the values that we grew up on. And, some of them stick with you and some don't.
And can you pinpoint to a time or to a moment where you like, where you had some sort of political awakening or so? Was it the Bosnian War?
Yeah, that was a eye opener because I did go to Zagreb in 1993, and that's the closest I got, was speaking with some refugees from Bosnia and Herzegovina there. And then going to the Croatian countryside and seeing all the damage and devastation and the just bad attitudes, anger, and then coming back to the United States and saying, wow, this is a really good system we have here because it's peaceful and we resolve our conflicts like in, for better or for worse, courts, or you can go to your city council or your legislature and it's a peaceful system. So if once there's a vacuum of power, the lesson I learned from you,
from Tito.
Yeah, Tito. Well, Tito left and then the Yugoslavia hung on for about 11 years and then it fell apart. People were manipulating nationalism. They had that Jedinstvo, which means like unity, one, you know, people coming together as Yugoslavians. However, there was pressure with, you know, the Berlin Wall. Again, that when that fell, that just changed the whole scenario in Eastern Europe.
Yep.
And then the economic, there's a lot of economic pressure, inflation, and these centralized political systems. And so there were these governments were transitioning to different power structures. And along the way, there were opportunities for criminals to try to fill that vacuum in Yugoslavia. There were criminals were all, you know, politicians or, you know, military leaders. And then they, you know, used nationalism and, to, fan the flames of, discontent for their own power. Cause it's so easy to do. I mean, we see that here in the United States. We've seen it for a long time in the United States, just like petty nationalism. And so that was the lesson I learned. It's like, it's good to just, you know, have these institutions and it's good to challenge institutions also, but in a nonviolent, comprehensive way. And then to always have, if you're going to challenge the institution, is to present an alternative to it. So say, okay, well, this isn't working. Therefore, I'm proposing this, and this is why I think this is a better system. So that basically what I do now in the United States is I do these transformational politics. And this is not big news for people in Germany because you have proportional representation in your Bundestag and in your local elections. And, but we have proportional representation in the United States, but on these local, on the local level, but it's, there are few, there are not very many, about 100 places in the United States to use it. But not the version in Germany. But we, I think, and the group Fair Vote I work with, we think that the time has come for the United States for proportional representation in the United States House of Representatives. There's no constitutional barrier to this kind of reform. It promises to alleviate the political polarization, give voters more voices and more choices. And we have this really problem in the United States. We call it gerrymandering. So manipulating of lines. So political elites, insiders, partisan hacks, they draw the lines to benefit themselves. And we believe that proportional representation is really the only remedy.
All right. You're already marching. Good.
Yes.
So you're marching right into it. So are you, so what exactly are you proposing? Because, I mean, that's very fundamental things that you are talking about here.
Yeah, you know, there's no barrier to the United States Constitution is really silent on how the election method for the United States House, and it says like there, you know, Congress can make its own qualifications and its own rules for how it elects the House. Changing the United States Senate is really would be really hard because that's a constitutional amendment. Electoral college would be really hard, constitutional amendment. But there's some ways to work with states because states have a lot of power with the way they appoint, presidential electors. But with Fair Vote, we're proposing the system, the single transferable vote. It's basically the way the Australian Senate is elected. Ireland Dáil, their national legislature, Malta uses it. These are just like, you know, national systems. So it's, mm-hmm. it's a preferential ballot. It's where you rank the candidates first, second, third choice. Cause you have to remember in the United States, we don't really, even in English speaking countries around the world, there's no tradition of like party-less systems like you have in Germany. It's a right. more of a candidate.
You go straight for the candidate.
Yeah, it's a candidate-based system.
But we have both. We have a candidate and we have a second vote for the party.
Yeah, mixed member proportional. And New Zealand adopted that system about 10 years ago or so, and it's been very successful. Mm-hmm. We'd like to see that here in the United States. Sure, we'd take it, like mixed member proportional. However, there's a bill now in the United States Congress, in the United States House of Representatives, called the Fair Representation Act, and it proposes this preferential voting, single transferable vote to elect representatives to the U.S. House.
And who's pushing that bill?
Representative Don Beyer of Virginia is the prime sponsor.
Well, when you think about that, it's more like which corporation is pushing that bill?
There's no corporations pushing this bill.
So it's not going to go anywhere.
Well, no, it can if people really find out. I mean, I think FairVote has a compelling message for urban Democrats. I mean, I'm sorry, urban Republicans, Republicans and conservatives who live in urban areas that are overwhelmingly Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we have a message for urban Democrats. And that is, there's so many Democrats packed in these urban areas that their vote is diluted. There's just like, you only get to vote for one person.
Because of the lines that are
right. And there's 80% Democrats in there. It's just like, there's all these like surplus votes.
Yeah.
So that would help Democrats. And we have a message for, rural Democrats. They're always in the minority in rural places.
Mm-hmm.
So we're saying, that's why we call it the Fair Representation Act. And if you pay taxes and if you're subject to the laws and the rules of the land, you should at least get some representation.
Right.
And so the idea is to have a constituency, a district that could elect maybe 3, 4, or 5 members, whatever the system is. And you would rank your candidates, your first choice, your second choice, your third choice, say in a 3-seat district. And then, there's like a formula in the way you distribute the votes, but there's a threshold. See, in Germany, the threshold to get elected is like 3 or 4%, something like that.
5%.
Yeah. Well, you know, Russia threshold is 8%. In, the system
safety. Well, Russia isn't exactly a prime example of.
It isn't, but they have, you know, it takes 8% to get elected in their Duma.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, you know, in Israel has like, they just raised their threshold up to like three, almost four. They've been raising their threshold too. Well, say in a 3-seat district in the United States, the threshold to be elected would be 25%.
Right.
So it's very conservative. So that's why I say it's like the American version of proportional representation, which Americans need to hear. If you're proposing something like this, there's higher thresholds to get elected than European system.
But you only have the choice between two parties in this country, basically. I mean,
that's for a variety of reasons. Okay. A lot of that has to do with, of course, winner take all elections where you just get one winner. And so voters just rationally flock to one party or the other. Okay. But it goes deeper than that in the various states, the way, these major parties are effectively state parties.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so their nominations are paid for and conducted by the state. So they have these primaries and these major parties just qualify automatically to get on the ballot mm-hmm. for a primary election. However, there are ballot access barriers for minor parties and third parties and independents. It's much harder to get on the ballot. So there's these institutional barriers that benefit the major parties. So they're like state parties. And didn't, you know, East Germany used to have state parties, right?
Okay.
Well, the United States has state parties. They're not necessarily rubber stamp parties like they had in East Germany. However, they are joined to the hip with the state and actually, you know, with the state legislatures and with the United States Congress. And then there are also the state parties are these money laundering operations. They're these political machines that sell access to government. The state legislature in each chamber, if you're in your legislature, you'll have a Democratic Campaign Caucus Committee. You'll have a Republican Campaign Caucus Committee. And that's the leadership of the major party in that chamber. And what they do is they're a money machine. So if you go and you have a meeting and then say, hey, you got to, you know, it's kind of a pay-to-play system. And then the big...
That noise?
The heater came on. I can turn it off. Off money laundering machines.
Yeah. Go back to that. Okay, so we turned the heat off.
Yeah, so basically... You know, they sell access to the legislature, and then that gives them economic superiority over these struggling small parties who don't have a lot of money.
Are there struggling small parties?
Yeah, there's like Green Party, Libertarian Party. I know California has Peace and Freedom Party. But now, California, Washington State, there's this new novel law that was approved by the United States Supreme Court where it basically... effectively kills parties. It's a nonpartisan system where even if you're not a nominee of a party, you could claim membership to the party on the ballot itself. And it's a device basically that's been engineered to kill political association. That's how bad things are in the United States.
Let me understand that.
We don't have free association in the United States as far as ballots.
Can you explain that? I don't think
okay,
I got that.
So... In 2008, the United States Supreme Court approved the state of Washington's election system where you can go on the ballot and if you're as a candidate and you can say, I prefer the Democratic Party or I prefer the Republican Party. And then the Republicans or Democrats have no say on the ballot itself, wow, who their nominee is. And then there's a disclaimer on the ballot that says, the nominees of parties may not necessarily be the nominee of this party. And you can, but you get in Washington, you can say anything up to 16 characters. It's kind of like a mini Twitter. So some people say, I prefer Salmon Yoga Party. I prefer No New Taxes Party. I prefer, Republican Party. It just depends on what it is. But the idea behind it is to effectively kill political association. And so what happens is you have a lack of transparency in elections and you have all these like political groups operating in the shadows.
Right.
And then a group of people who bother to establish a political party, really their power has been negated by the state.
Huh. So is that a way in for like groups like the PACs and the super PACs?
It can be, yeah. It can be. I mean, it all seems to work in concert. The United States Congress needs to pass better transparency laws. However, with Republicans in power, that's not going to happen. They're just really reckless and corrupt. I voted Libertarian for president. I didn't vote Democratic Party in the last election. And I'm disenchanted with both major parties. However, you have to hand it to Democrats where they are open to these kinds of systems where, you know, more transparent elections where Republicans are just.
But isn't the Libertarian just like the further side, freakier stuff of the,
no, not
the
really.
Tea Party?
No, not necessarily.
No.
There can be in the Libertarian Party, but there's like factions in the Libertarian Party, but you see like, and I'm not a libertarian with a capital L. Like I'm not a party member, and
I think libertarians are dangerous.
They're not dangerous. No, libertarians are more centrist, is what they are. They can be more like in the United Kingdom, liberal democratic party or liberal democrat. I know there's a distinction there, but it's more of a centrist where they're economically, they're fiscally conservative, but they're socially liberal. They do things like support gay marriage. You know,
really?
Legal marijuana. Oh, yeah. 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 More freedom, pro-choice. But, you know, they want lower taxes. So it just seems, you know, then the Republican Party is just anymore after Trump was elected is just a reactionary party. And it seems like, Democrats too can just, they're just really reactionary. They don't really have a good agenda. Neither like Republicans and Democrats like to spend money, but they never really offer how to pay for it. And so United States is over $20 trillion in debt now and rising.
soon to be 24.
Yeah, it's going to go higher. Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a real problem, but people are just kind of, you know,
oblivious to
it. They don't really care. They're into, like, you know, people are freaked out about Donald Trump, or they're freaked out about Hillary Clinton. Even though Clinton lost the election, they're still, like, out to get her. It's just crazy. Yeah. You know, politics in the United States are like, I just do my transformational advocacy of proportional representation, and I don't get involved in these, like, social media politics that are just really shallow and reactionary and poor thought through.
It's just
sound bites, yeah, and clicks. I'm not interested in it.
But I think at the root of the problem in this country is the campaign financing and what you're saying on the state level, the access to legislation. But at the end of the day, people are dependent on the donors.
Congress
is for sale.
Okay. Oh, you know what I did? I went to college from 2010 to 2016, and I got a degree in social sciences.
Oh, wow. You're a late bloomer.
I'm a late bloomer. Okay. And nice. So then I studied a lot of political science. And so basically political science is a soft science. And there's nothing like, you know, gravity, like when you do you want to shoot a rocket in the sky, then there's a formula on how to do that. You know where that rocket's going to land because that's a hard science. Okay. Social sciences is a soft science. You can't really put your finger on it. I don't really think that campaign finance reform is the big issue. And first of all, I'll tell you what we need is to take contribution limits away. You can give money, as much money as you want, to whoever you want. However, there needs to be real-time disclosure of who's giving the money. Mm-hmm. And I've looked at studies where people could make up their mind about what a candidate's about when they know who's giving them the money. Instead, we have these individual campaign contribution limits. You can only give someone running for Congress only, you know, like about $5,000. It's an individual campaign contribution limit. Okay. So what that does when you make this limit, because policies have consequences. Okay. So you come up with this idea. We're going to put a limit on what the contributions are. It's only going to be $5,000. Like, yay, bravo. That's a good idea. We're going to get money out of politics. Well, then that just gives people incentive to find another way to get the money in, okay?
And what's the other way?
It's like a leaky roof. Water finds its way in.
Right.
Okay, well, you start a political action committee, or you start an organization, then you call it Citizens for Better Tomorrow, Citizens for Better America, paid for by citizens, you know. Well, you know, so it's like, it's sketchy,
but
right?
That opens the floodgates for
What if we had a system in the United States where we had free association, where if you want to start a political party, all parties are on equal ground. All parties have the same chance to get elected. And then if we, with the modern technology of the internet, because social networking and political association are related. And there's this book by a House in Winograd called Millennial Makeover, and they're generational theorists. And so the thesis of this book is that whoever figures out in the United States how to merge political association and social networking will dominate politics for the next generation.
But haven't people figured that out already?
They haven't figured it out because there's all these smoke screens. It's like, well, we need to get money out of politics. And it's just like, and then you have all these problems when you want to get money out of politics. And that was the whole Citizens United, case. Are you familiar with that?
No,
that's a big thing here in the United States, but it's basically, it turned the Federal Election Commission into a state censorship board. And it said, basically, they were telling people that you couldn't run a certain type of political ad or political movie because it was campaign, it was electioneering. So it's, you have all these policies have consequences. So better to go the freedom route and say, well, you can give people as much money as you want, but they need to disclose who it is. Okay. Or you need to disclose who the top donors are. Mm-hmm. That would be legal too. And second, we need free political association. And the parties, and you think the Democratic and Republican parties they should open up the system and have, like, we want to have, like, nominations where it's an open door policy. We're going to run our own primaries and have a more community grassroots system. But Republicans and Democrats aren't interested in that. Their job is to keep a lid on grassroots and participation. They're more interested in raising the money and buying TV ads.
And that's what the half the time they're spending their time on is raising money.
Right.
And that opens the doors for direct influence from those people who are donors. And
well, you could have a system where, you can have a party where you can pay $5 a month to be a member of the party. And that membership buys you privileges. So you could be a part of the social network of, the party. Like, you see, the House and Weiniger theory is, again, is to merge social networking and political association. So if you have, say, like a Facebook type of interface for your party where people can post things and post images and post opinions, but also nominate candidates.
But isn't that going on?
No.
That's what's happening.
No.
Movimiento
Estrella. I don't speak Italian. I can kind of speak Spanish. So it's my, you know, the Five Star Movement. Movement in Italy. It's Movimento Estrella.
Yeah.
Estrella.
I don't know what that is.
It's Five Star Movement. And it was a virtual party sprang up in Italy about four or five years ago. And they, because of proportional representation, they won seats. And I think they even won many seats in the Sardinia legislature. But they used social networking. They used meetups. They used the tools for people to come together and organize online. And then they presented their message to voters.
Mm-hmm.
And they captured the imagination of enough voters. And then they won seats.
But we've got the exact same thing going on in Germany right now, only it's a party on the far right who started out as Eurosceptics and then they moved towards a sort of anti-Islam. Now they're like adopted most of the Tea Party ideas, you know, it's like, oh, you know, pro-choice is not really happening, it shouldn't be happening, da da da.
That's one thing you get elected, it's another thing to pass laws.
And when these people, you know, when they were gearing up, social media was all they had, of course, and they've used that and used that to great effect. They're now 13% in the last election. They have 97 seats in the Bundestag and they're all over it. And it's a scary thought because these people are full on, you know, they're
well, in the United States system, we have a minority rule system. You get these Republicans who lost the last election, the popular vote,
mm-hmm.
but the Electoral College has a conservative bias. And then you have like these Tea Party members who are minority of the Republican Party. And then they're somehow in control. They shut down the government. So United States is a very unstable democracy and it is a minority of a minority rule system. Okay.
Right.
And so there needs to be these reforms like, the Fair Representation Act, or at least there could voters decide who gets in. Instead of these elites gerrymandering districts. And second, what the promise is of the Fair Representation Act is to elect more moderate lawmakers. And that's what preferential ballots do. They tend to do that. They'll elect more moderate people. And you'll get more moderate people because you'll get more urban Republicans. You'll get more rural Democrats who aren't really tend not to be so extreme.
So where is that at with the Fair Representation Act?
Well, we've got the bill and, we introduced the bill this year. And so it's just a process. And, it was a goal and a victory for Fair Vote, the group I work with, to just have the bill introduced in the first place. And these things take time. Mm-hmm. And so you have to go up against these huge institutional barriers. Professional politicians who...
All right, we're back on.
Well, and it's totally hard because you have professional politicians who... You have professional politicians who just think of their own careers and they're not going to want any kind of system that challenges their incumbency.
Right, so who's going to support this bill?
Well, we have three sponsors so far.
It's them sowing the branch they sit on, no? I mean...
Things are so bad, people are starting to respond to it. Right now... A lot of attention is on gerrymandering. A lot of attention is on process because look at the effects of the election system, what we get.
So would that also change the Electoral College as in?
No.
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 Because that's what nobody understands where I come from. You know, you've got a vote that has
It's the states, basically. There's no individual right to elect a president in the United States.
No, I know, I understand it, but it doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, it made a lot of sense in the 18th century, I guess, and it's still here. And so I'm excited about the potential for ranked choice voting again, preferential ballot to in each state for each, if a state could choose to use this, because under the United States Constitution, the state chooses which manner to appoint presidential electors. So you could have here in Washington State, we could have on the ballot says United States president, and then you just rank the candidates, their first choice, second choice, third choice. And that way you could say, hey, I'm going to vote this third party or second party. And then whoever, if the rules could say that whoever gets the majority of first, second, or third choices, because the way the formula works, will get all the electors, at least you'd get a majority winner.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had in a lot of states in this 2016 election, it was a plurality winner. They didn't, and even Trump in the primaries, which were state sponsored, party functions,
mm-hmm.
state sponsored and financed party functions, because of the rules, it's a perfect example of what I'm seeing when I said earlier about the state parties, because the what happened is the state paid for the election, the state conducted the election. However, the way that the delegate system went for the nomination of this private group, that was for party rules.
What,
okay.
What private group?
The Republican Party.
Private group. Okay.
Well. Yeah. That's a Republican Party is supposed to be a private group, but there's this gray area between the Republican Party and the state. They're a state party,
mm-hmm.
just like the Democrats are.
What does that mean? They're state financed?
Yeah. Well, there's two things. They're joined at the hip.
Okay. Well, that's a different thing.
When you go to the state legislature and you want to do business, mm-hmm. okay, it's a good idea to give the parties money.
Oh, because then they're going to help you open a door.
Yeah. Because you could only give an individual candidate so much, because mm-hmm. there's rules. Every state has a rule on how much you could give a state candidate, their candidates for their legislature. 50 states have 50 different rules.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's only one set of rules for the United States Congress, and there's limits there. So you could only give I think it's around $4,000 or $5,000, something like that. Maybe it's even $2,500 for an individual. I'm sorry, I don't have.
But any. I don't think that's much to get hung up about, because there's so many other ways to funnel
money
to them.
That's what I mean. Yeah. But so one of the means to give the money is you give the money to the party,
mm-hmm.
because there's different rules for the party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the parties they've set up shop in the legislatures, in the Congress, and then they sell access to it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have in their respective states, there are laws that give the major parties preferential treatment. They get on the ballot automatically. Their nominations are paid for by the state. Their nominations are conducted by the state. So they're like state parties.
Okay.
That's the system.
Yeah.
In the United States.
And so this country has so many different and such a multi-layer of problems. Like, I don't even know where to start
I don't know where to start either. No, like, it's a really fascinating time now. Like debt, over $20 trillion debt.
But you've got a corporate induced, opiate epidemic.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, rural, there's rural opiates. Yeah. Yeah. And urban too. Yeah. The whole thing.
And no one's doing anything about that.
I don't know what you can do. I don't know what to do. I mean, I don't do those things.
No, I know, but it's just, so you've got a gun problem, I think, because at least you've got more shootings than any
there's
other
like
country.
Shootings. Yeah. It's incredible.
And,
but how do you correlate that to what is the cause of that?
That's
hard to do.
That's what I mean. But who's going to, if you want to change those things, if you want to bring change about, I mean, you're going to the root, you know, you're going to the voting process, but
right.
in the hopes that policies will change. correct? Is that
yeah
is,
to that's have the basically have a more fair system? I don't like the system. Yeah, policies will change, and maybe we'll get some more rational policies instead of reactionary policies. What we're getting right now.
Well, you have corporate policies. I think you know the corporation. The tax cut is now is happening. They're getting corporate. They
didn't.
Taxes
from what down. I've read, is the corporations really didn't want a tax cut.
No, oh, because all their money is outside.
Well, it's like I think that whole tax cut was just politics, and you know if they want to cut taxes. The deal why the tax cuts were irresponsible because they didn't do any spending cuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's $1.5 trillion more and deeper in the hole, a $20 trillion hole.
Right. And tons of people, and it's a bargaining game where a lot of people are losing.
There were no public hearings.
Healthcare is
involved. Yeah, it's bad. Yeah. And then they took that, individual mandate out. So they took a wrecking ball to that. So basically they killed insurance for people. And so, but then they don't have any solution saying, hey, the healthcare in the United States is these healthcare companies are most of them are nonprofits. Most of the healthcare companies are like, they're like a Catholic charity or some kind of nonprofit. Check it out.
Really?
Yes, really. And then they have these boards of directors, and it's a system that just has gone, has spun out of control. And so basically you have this, you don't have any like really advertised pricing. You have, these agreements between insurance companies and these providers.
Mm-hmm.
And then these providers will do things like they don't even disclose like how much a surgery cost or some kind of medical procedure costs, or they'll like inflate prices for like bandages or whatever.
Right.
It's so, just, so they're basically spinning out of control. And then these chairmen of the board, these board members make millions of dollars in compensation. It's kind of a scam system. So in the United States, we have Medicare.
The health care is extraordinarily expensive in this country.
Oh, it's crazy. Because they're gouging people.
And the health insurance is fairly dysfunctional because once you have a real problem, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Even if you have insurance.
Yeah. Even if you have insurance and their premiums are going up. And so they came up with this system in 2009, they came up with the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things the way they made the system is that you have to have insurance or you'll get a fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's called the mandate. And so Republicans don't like that because they think it's like against freedom or whatever.
Yeah, and they try to stop that at every.
But what happens is, and so they're taking the mandate out, and then all the young, healthy people are not. They feel fine now, so they're not gonna pay health insurance. So all these healthcare is gonna collapse basically.
Mm-hmm.
But see, Republicans, they don't have any proposal. Like when I started this interview, it's just like, well, if you propose a policy, why don't you offer an alternative? Okay. So I'm not an expert. I feel comfortable speaking about election reform and that kind of politics. And so I'm still studying healthcare in the United States, but we have this system called Medicare, and it's for certain, it's for older people. And so what happens is that when, the federal government, United States government will pay for, people's health procedures and healthcare. Right. But what happens is that the providers, the hospitals and doctors, physicians, they send representatives to this like meeting. It's like an annual meeting, sort of regular meeting or whatever. And then they decide on what the prices are that the federal government's going to pay. Mm-hmm. So they're basically fixing prices,
mm-hmm.
right?
And they're outrageously high.
But not for Medicare. Okay. These are negotiated prices. Okay. It's because if you get sick and then you go into, there's like so many examples, like you get sick and something happens and you get this bill. It's just like, my bill's $50,000. Like right. What happened? And they don't tell you. And it's just like, it's kind of a racket.
But that's what I mean.
Okay. With Medicare, the prices it's price fixing is what it is. And I don't think that price fixing is a good idea. However, it seems like in the United States that the situation is so out of control, like maybe that's a viable policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so some people are saying that we should have like Medicare for all. And that might be a good idea. But again, I'm looking into it, but I guess my point is, and I'm not, I'm just, I know there's people listening to this podcast saying, well, he's not an expert, and I agree. So, you know, I'm just kind of like, you know, somebody who's trying to pay attention. So I have a lot to learn about it, but I think that what I would like to see, and what I'm not seeing from Republicans or Democrats, is a, like a comprehensive policy saying, okay, this is what, this is, you know, there's, this is what we propose for, yeah, for healthcare in the United States. We just don't get that. Mm-hmm. It's just crazy politics in the United States. We just can't get, we hear over and over and over and over and over and over and over again how bad Trump is. And then the people on the right hear over and over and over and over and over and over again how bad Hillary is. You know, like Trump's tweeting crooked Hillary. And it's just like the politics are so unsophisticated. Well, it's just crazy.
The media reporting as well. It's not like, you know.
Well, it depends on where you get it. Yeah.
Well, you turn on the TV and you, I never feel like I get a sort of neutral reporting of what's going on. Instead, I'm getting some agenda being pushed all the time.
I've been 30 years, even before the internet, and we have like these like legacy media companies, and they sold us on the first Iraq war. Mm-hmm. You know, they just sell us a pile of crap. So I'm not, you know, and then people are so like, Democrats are so freaked out about Trump. Now they're like trusting the FBI. And it's just like, you know, hey, wait a minute. Okay. It's like,
yeah,
I guess, I mean, it's good. The FBI does good work, I'm sure, but, or, you know, they're trusting CIA or whatever, anything that anybody who comes out after or State Department or whatever, like, aren't these the people that like,
well, they're desperate.
Didn't they support the Shah of Iran and like, yeah, you know what I mean? They're in bed with the Saudis that are crooked, you know, crooked.
They've been selling weapons to the Saudis.
They sell, oh, United States is horrible with, yeah, all these weapons.
Oh yeah.
You know, and it's just like, wow. And there's gun fetishism in the United States. It's just like, I don't know. So basically, that's kind of the political spiel. And so I just do what I could do. I play in a band. I play in two bands.
You play in two bands right,
yeah,
now?
I play in two bands. Yeah.
All right. Tell
me. That's why I'm setting up this computer so I can kind of, I bought this cheap $120. I bought that for $200. It works good. Anyway.
What are the bands?
Giants in the Trees.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that's a local band here.
Yeah. And another local band, Sparpole. I'm sorry. Butterfly launches off Sparpole, mm-hmm, and Ray's in that band with me too.
And what kind of music is it?
Well, this is kind of like fun music. It's really, it's got accordion in it. So
was it ever not fun for you to make music?
No, it's always was fun. That's, but this is like, some bands are kind of serious or like dark,
yeah,
or whatever.
Right.
So we are just like a fun band and we're not political at all. Okay. And then the other band is more arty. Butterfly launches off Sparpole. And again, but it's about science and nature. But again, it's just more fun. It's not political. And,
did you play out?
Yeah, we have a show coming up here in, December 30th in Astoria. We got our website right here. Check out our website. It'll tell you all our shows,
okay,
right there. And, you know, I have privilege. I could live out here in the country and I, you know, just have a good time.
Jack and Dino.
Yeah. Jack and Dino recorded it. Sure.
You've come full circle.
Yeah. There you go. I've worked with Jack. We did, yeah, recorded that Flipper record back in like 2007 or 8, I think it was.
Huh.
And then we did. Yeah. So I don't know.
So how much of your time do you spend on this political stuff?
Well, I do so many things. I put some, like today I'll put like maybe, you know, I'll send like emails or I went to Olympia. I spent a couple hours just getting to Olympia in a meeting. So about 3 hours going to Olympia, the state capitol. I got a meeting there on Monday.
You got pretty, didn't you get pretty active in the presidential election? Did this three questions thing that you did?
Oh yeah, I did the three questions and that was just more centrist thing. It's just like, hey everybody, you know, what are you going to do about climate change? What are you going to do about political reform? And, what are you going to do? What was the three questions again? And the debt. So what are you going to do about those three things? Because they weren't part of the
discourse.
No, it was all just like Trump is a freak and we hate Hillary.
And Trump is a freak.
Yeah, and that was it. And then they wouldn't allow the third parties in the debate. You know, there was in.
Oh, but that's apparently all handled between the parties and the TV stations, right? They just
they're a cartel. Mm-hmm. It's a cartel, is what it is. I'm saying they're state parties. You know, state parties control the media.
Right.
See how it works? Yeah. United States, we have state parties.
Yeah, but it's terrible.
There was a Council of Europe. They wrote a paper in 2010, and they were condemning United Russia Party and for the elections that they had, and they were condemning Council of Europe condemned Russia for two things: that their party candidates refused to appear in public debates with other parties, and that United Russia, as the leading party in the Duma, raised the threshold for representation from 5% to 8%.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like,
wait.
It takes 50% of the vote to get elected in the United States.
Right.
And then I was supported Gary Johnson for president, and he wasn't allowed to be in the debates.
Yeah,
didn't seem fair.
And then there's this other thing. I remember Nader was running, and when you said, "Oh, I'm going to vote for Nader," your Democratic friends would say, "Oh no, you can't do that. That's going to take."
Told me that, and I said, "Why don't you vote for my guy?"
Right.
Okay. And then they told me afterwards, "Are you happy now, Chris?" And I said, "Hey, your candidate lost. You should have voted with me, and we would have won."
Right.
But see how pompous people are?
But they tell you he lost because of
you. Yeah, because they think they're so smart, and they can't even tell you who their congressman is, and they're going to tell me how to vote. And I said, "Oh, well, next time I'll just give you my ballot and you can vote for me because you're so smart."
Have you ever considered running for some office yourself?
No, I don't need a job.
Right. No, you don't.
I don't think I'd be here right now if I was either. So I don't know. I'm in a band. I play in two bands, and my politics are like transformational politics. I do work on this voting reform. It's a lot of work. It's a big, big, big deal if we ever get it. And in the meantime, I'm not a crusader. I just, you know, have as much fun as possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that Vladimir Ilyich Lenin?
Yeah, it's a painting. Wall?
Why is he on your wall? Are you a commie?
No, I'm not. I found that it was really cheap in a secondhand store.
Uh-huh.
And I bought it because I thought it was a poster, and I looked at it, and it's a painting.
Wow.
And they said that it came out of some bureau or something in Vladivostok.
Huh.
So, yeah.
This looks good right up there.
Yeah, that was above some like commissar's desk or something, but it's a painting.
Right.
So that's why I bought it, and it was like $50 or something for a painting.
Yeah. He's a dude. Well, he was one. All right. No,
he's still, you can go look at him. He's still there.
I know. All right. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for explaining all of this to me. It's complicated.
Yeah, but that's what's going on in the United States. Even people here explain.
Here's the system. Whoa. Did you hear that? Did you hear how much drive and energy and passion and love this man has for his work as an activist and for these topics? Krist Novoselic, great stuff. He clearly knows to point to the undemocratic elements in the American electoral system. And his characterization of the two parties joined at the hip, their stranglehold on access to the electorate, that's all pretty spot on, I would say. I gotta say though, there were a few points in this talk where, in hindsight, I do regret that I didn't call him out on his libertarian view about the unlimited money flow. Come on. The idea that candidates should get unlimited contributions as long as it is known who shells out the money? I think that's very inappropriate. The money is the frigging problem and the dependency on it. And come on, there's plenty of other systems that provide government funding for political candidates. It doesn't have to be corporations, interest groups. So the idea that campaign funding could actually be deregulated as long as there is an element of transparency involved? I don't think so.
I find it hard to believe that he believes in that, but it's actually not cool or fair of me to call this out now, because he's not here with me. We should have done that there and then. So I just want to thank Chris for being available, making his point, and I promise to you guys, I will not go all political again for a while. I thought this was pretty heavy. So let's go back to the arts and other fun things next couple of weeks. So come back soon. There'll be more where this came from. Thanks again for tuning in. I don't know, should I say something like, give me a good rating or something on iTunes on the podcast? Oh, forget it. My name is Christoph Ellinghaus, and I'm out of here. Back. Thank you.